ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Roddy Doyle's career can be measured out in families. There's his own, of course, wife and three kids. And there's the Rabbits, that's R-A-B-B-I-T-T-S, the Rabbits of the Barrytown books that began with The Commitments 40 years ago. And, of course, there's the Spencers, who first appeared on television 30 years ago, and then in a series of celebrated novels, including his latest, The Women Behind the Door. One of the finest writers in a nation of great writers, Roddy Doyle is here for Sydney Writers' Festival and joins me in the studio now. Welcome.
Thank you.
How have you lived with these families for so long?
Well, my own is no problem.
Well, you've got no choice.
They're real. I think, say, with Paula Spencer, took me so long to get to know her that she wouldn't go away then. And I put so much of myself into her. It's not obvious because our lives are so different. I mean, she's a woman. She's an alcoholic, which I'm not. She's been the victim of violence that I can't even imagine. And I've never witnessed violence in any of the homes I've lived in. So there was so much that was so far away from me that I had to really dig deep to get up close to her. And she's the one character that I've created who has, fooled me into thinking that she might have existence outside of my own work. Off the page.
Free will, wandering about on her own, making her own decisions.
Kind of. Now, I know that's nonsense, but at the same time, it just feels like that now and again. So the day I went to get my first COVID vaccination and enjoyed the experience, enjoyed what I was looking at, took place in a theatre near to where I live, converted. The booths were up on stage. And I remembered seeing a stage version of my book, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, on that stage.
On that stage?
Yeah. When I was coming away, having spent time queuing up with people my own age, lived from the same part of Dublin, and looking at the contrast between the way the women were dressed, bit of a day out for them, and the men were dressed, you know, as drab as humanly possible without being actually dead.
And the women in better condition than the men?
Making more of an effort and actually being able to communicate with one another, chatting away, even though they were all respecting the social distance and the rules, they were still able to chat away, whereas the men were tended to be just looking straight ahead as if, you know, they were going to jail. And I was driving home and the thought popped into my head, I wonder what Paula would have made of that, you know.
Yeah.
So by the time I parked the car, and I wasn't far away, I could have walked it in 40 minutes, but I drove. So it was a short drive and, you know, waiting at the traffic lights, I began to wonder, well, how would she have got there? Because I knew where she lives and I knew she would have been going to the same centre as I did. And I began to wonder, as I said, how would she have got there? And then I decided she'd have got a lift from a friend of hers. So I invented this friend, Mary, had her name. I didn't have to dig too deep to come up with the name Mary.
Not in Ireland, no.
You know, and being of that age. And by the time I parked the car, I had the start of the novel and really the reason why I'd be writing the novel and why she'd be coming back for a third book. So it was, in so many ways, a great day. You know?
There's going to be an army of PhDs written one day, isn't there, about the COVID novel. For two reasons. One, as a great subject matter, and as it is in The Women Behind the Doors. But the other, of course, is that it was, if you weren't encumbered with children, Roddy, it was a great time for writers. You got an awful lot of writing done.
Well, I had two adult children in the house, so there were four of us.
Oh.
Yeah. One of them hadn't moved out and one of them came back. So there were four of us in the house. It wasn't a great time for writing at first. I had a novel coming out. It was postponed. I had a musical version of my novel, The Commitments, that was going to go on tour. That was postponed. I had a new play that was cancelled. And a version of Peter Pan that I wrote set in Dublin
what?
That was supposed to be going on. And that was postponed. That eventually, I saw that the year before last. So everything was, and all these announcements or all the phone calls, I got them within 3 or 4 days of the first lockdown. So, and I realised I was working on a novel and I binned it because the present day in which it was set didn't exist anymore.
It had gone.
It had gone. And there was no sign of it coming back. So I started writing short stories, most of them set during COVID, because I thought moments would capture what we were living through. So, for example, I'm not sure about here, but we were a good few months into the experience before masks became a fashion item, so to speak, you know,
yes.
Where masks became mandatory. And there weren't any masks at first. But then I wrote a story about these masks, because it became a new form of litter, like the Batman logo lying around, you know, on what was normally a wet surface, the ground in Ireland. There were all these sort of blue bat-like shapes where then, because it was masks had
abandoned
been discarded.
Masks.
Yeah, yeah. So I wrote that, and then the good news, it went, we were allowed to walk more than 2K, we could walk 5, which meant I could walk in the opposite direction towards the city centre and past it. And I began to imagine a man looking at these deserted streets on the news and thinking to himself, it's a good opportunity to go find his son who he hasn't seen in years and years and years. He's somehow in his head, he thinks, if the streets are empty, I'll see him. So I began to write that story, a man walking through the city. So I used these little opportunities as the year progressed and wrote a collection of short stories. So from that point of view, it was material, all right. But I didn't trust myself. Well, it's not that I didn't trust myself. I didn't trust the world.
That it was
that
ever
I
going
couldn't
to come
start
back again.
A novel. No, I wasn't sure about that. But I thought if I start a novel set today, I'll only be, you know, 10,000 words in and something will happen and it won't be today anymore. But coming home from the first COVID vaccination, it felt like the beginning of the end, you know? And I felt like maybe things are getting back to normal. And I began to think, yeah, I can start writing a novel.
The first lockdown, we all felt heroic, didn't we?
Yes, to a degree. I'm not sure if heroic...
That may be overdoing it.
I was in the UK when Ireland went into lockdown. And it was business as usual, that twit who was running England.
A lot of people died as a result of business as usual.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
I was in Edinburgh and then going on to Newcastle on a Friday and I got off the train in Newcastle and it was Stag and Hen Central. And the foyer of the hotel I was staying in was full of men from Northern Ireland at a stag party and they were dressed, they were dressed like the cast of Hawaii Five-O in Newcastle, which is... You know, freezing.
It had a Hawaii theme, a stag party with a Hawaii theme.
I don't
theme.
Know if it had a...
Oh, the fun.
I think the theme had been, they were just in the gear, but they weren't pretending they were in Hawaii, that's for sure. But, you know, you don't drink Newcastle brown ale by the pint in Hawaii, I think. But what was the steam, it was just the air. I was in the, walking into this... breath, you know, and suddenly even getting into the lift, because I got into the lift or the elevator and it was the smell of many men's aftershave. And, you know, I was thinking, this is lethal. This is dangerous. Yeah. And I was stuck there for another 24 hours. So coming home to Ireland, I didn't know what to expect. And then actually, Ireland was the adult in the room, behaving reasonably and properly. And so there was, I suppose, heroism. There was a certain heroism going down to the supermarket. one of the kids volunteering to go down to the supermarket. And
brave lad.
Brave, and a brave girl as well.
A brave girl.
Yeah,
both. Oh, well, of course, yes.
Both. But I knew it reached, we were taking turns doing the cooking and it was getting more and more adventurous. And my son was going down to the off-license to get the vermouth for the risotto. And I realised... If that kid comes back and infects us all because he needed a bottle of vermouth, and I wasn't even sure, to be honest, outside of Guinness, I'm really quite ignorant about alcohol. I didn't even know what, you know, at the age of whatever I was, I wasn't altogether certain what vermouth was.
Mm.
But I really thought, I don't want to die because he needed vermouth in the risotto. On the other hand, then I think chances are we're not going to die.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I'm talking to Roddy Doyle, who's here for Sydney Writers Festival. How deep down in yourself do you have to dig, to quote something you said a moment ago, to find a woman?
Well, you have to look for aspects of your life. And when I say your, I mean mine. Parenthood. Being a parent was a great help. Now, I didn't give birth to my children, but I was there. And feelings of pride, anxiety, mortality, shame on occasion, having a few drinks and then realising there's an emergency, you know, and trying to shake the head and, you know, produce clarity. All these things which we live through become material, become necessary, and finding the words that get there. So I found myself thinking about that a lot. And as you know, when I wrote The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, I had two kids and they were, you know, toddlers really. So it was a recent experience. So I wasn't working on memory. I was working on current affairs, so to speak, yes, you know.
The modern world.
Other aspects of it, her schooling, for example. Her memories of primary or elementary school are... very positive, as would mine be. Her memory then of her, you know, she didn't stay long in high school, but her memory of that, I kind of used some of the darker eccentricity of some of the teachers, Christian brothers, who taught me, even though I went through the full schooling and went on to university. So I enjoyed that, really. Other aspects... trying to recall my own very limited experience of violence, or not violence so much as pain, and trying to use that to allow her to describe her experience of pain, and trying to imagine, I enjoy a pint. I don't think I've ever felt the need, but I find it easy to imagine.
Yes, of having to have a drink.
Having to have a drink.
Yeah.
And I know and knew people who needed drink.
Mm. Mm.
So I could, again, it's all about really, it's not so much trying to live the event as find the words. It's all about the words.
Finding the words.
The character has no existence outside of the words on the page, really.
I would imagine that you have no patience whatever for those who say Tolstoy was not should not have written about Anna Karenin, that male novelists should not write about women, and vice versa. What was that woman doing writing about
to me,
Regency
it's all about
men?
The only thing that matters, is it any good? Do you know? Science fiction.
Could you say that again, please?
The only thing that matters, is it any good?
Thank you.
That's all that matters.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, Ursula Le Guin didn't live on any of the planets that she wrote so brilliantly about, but she selected the words to make those worlds so convincing. Yet she never lived those lives, so she shouldn't have written them. It would appear. So no, I've no time for that. Fiction is fiction. All that matters, is it any good?
The lives you write about very frequently are lives of people coping.
Yeah.
Coping seems an issue that grips your imagination. Why?
Because I think that's what we do. Some of us have to, for various circumstances, have more difficulty coping than others. Paula, leaving aside other considerations, she's married to a violent man. She has no money. She's no independence. So coping is heroic in her way, if she can. But we all have to cope. And that, I think, in many ways, it's admirable. I was just writing and doing a little bit of writing there this morning, just for the heck of it. I was kind of missing it a little bit. So I got a cup of coffee and I was sitting at a table just doing a bit of writing. And I was thinking about old men who put on their jackets and get the Zimmer frame out or the a crutch. Not necessarily two crutches, but one or a stick.
Yep.
And battle their way up to the pub. And have difficulty even getting up on the stool. But they do it because it gets them out of the house, it gets them company, and there's a little triumph in it, that they can still do it, and they're still there. And that, to me, in a tiny, tiny way, is heroic. You know, we hear about, and I'm sure it's the same here in Australia, but certainly I've heard in Ireland, that there are people who kind of almost literally have not come out of the house since COVID, because it's more comfortable in the house.
Yes.
And we're being encouraged in many, many ways to stay in the house. I'm not talking about older people.
Work from home.
Work from home. You know, you don't need human contact with anybody anymore. There are people, you know, madly in love with people they've never met. They don't get to know them. Mm. I'm not being critical of this, but it is quite disturbing in many ways. But these kind of men, and in a different context, women battle their way through physical ailment, through weather, in the case of Ireland, uphill, you know, just, and you can say, well, they're only going to the pub. But if you take down, you know, if you examine what the word pub means, public house, and they're bringing themselves into this room full of people, they're making the effort. And I find that in a tiny way, you used the word heroic at first, yeah, heroic in a way. And I'd like to think that, you know, not too far down the line, I'd be doing that myself.
Paula Spencer, who's the central figure in the Spencer family novels, has been abused by her husband.
Yeah.
Abuse seems also to be something that fascinates you. I mean, fascinates is perhaps the wrong word. But
interests
you, fires your imagination.
Well, yes, it does.
Why, do you think?
Well, in creatively, I wrote three novels, not planning to write three, but it ended up three, where it's an emotionally, the Rabbit family, the family of the Commitments, the Snapper and the Van, it's an emotionally successful family. The father is a decent man. The mother is a wise, middle-aged woman. Mm. The baby in the Snapper is actually, she's coming into a very packed house, but she's actually, I dare say, lucky to be in that house. She'll be loved. She'll be nurtured. She'll be looked after. She'll go to school. She'll be kept in school as long as possible. They'll try desperately to get her right through school and the first in the family to go to university or something. She won't be because one of the kids
because
goes
things there. Happen. Yes.
Yeah. But that'll be the effort. And I remember witnessing this in the 80s when I was writing those books. There was a huge change. You know, when I started teaching in 1979, most of the kids I was teaching left school at 15 after the first state exam. By the end of the 80s, most of them were staying on for the extra 2 years to finish formal education, you know, second level education. And I witnessed that. And in large part, and this is when the economy was on its knees, and a large part of it was down to the parents wanting more for their kids than they had had, reasonably enough. But it was actually measurable, tangible. It wasn't about money, really.
Mm. Staying on.
Yeah. And so these, when I was finishing the third book, I was thinking, well, enough is enough. What's it like next door? And in not literally next door, but I always imagined these families live in a terrace, you know, of council housing, state housing. And even if it's not literally next door, somewhere else on the estate, it's a different story. As I knew from being a teacher and actually growing up in the area, it's not all happy families, you know, it never is. I knew a guy who was deaf in one ear because of a battering he got from his father, you know. And a more middle-class home, really. But I began to think, I was invited by the BBC to write a television series, the one and only time I ever got an invitation like that. You know, I didn't know how abnormal that is, you know. And when
you were having a period of great success.
Yeah. I didn't know that at the time. I was just living it. I didn't take it for
granted.
The Booker
Prize was just something that came along and, you know.
Well, looking back on it, you know, the commitments, the film was released in 1991.
Everybody raved about it.
Yeah. Yes. It was the most commercially successful film in Ireland at the time. The Van came out within about 2 weeks of it. It was
Which is the third of the Barrytown novels.
Shortlisted for the Booker.
You were Ireland there briefly.
No.
You were the face of Ireland.
Maybe in the heads of people who didn't know Ireland all that way. But, and I never saw myself in those terms. But in a few years, not only in terms of the amount of work that I brought out, and that, you know, either was shortlisted or won prizes or movies, there was also on the same time becoming a father of one, then two children. It was a kind of hectic life. But going to meet the BBC producer, I just had in my head, father, child, child, mother, four episodes, each told from the point of view. I knew nothing about them. But as I began to think about it, I thought the father is a piece of work, you know, and he's going to bring that violence or the threat of it into the house. And I suppose then, consequences.
And the Spencer family is born in your head.
Yeah. And I wouldn't wish Charlo, the father, on any family, but creatively, you know, as material to keep you going for a year, he was dynamite. But then, if you like, a different kind of dynamite was the last episode, the mother, Paula. She'd flung him out of the house at this stage, so it's just about her coping. Back to that word, coping. And it's the least dramatic episode, but it was the most satisfying for me because it was the most difficult to write. And I did begin to wonder, as I wrote, how did she meet that man in the first place? What was it? And I wanted to do her justice. You know, she fell in love. And I think it's awful to think of that as a mistake. So I wanted to do her justice and became curious about her. And I could imagine her writing her own story. So that's how I began to write the novel.
Can I intervene here to say?
I'm not going to stop.
You are Mr. Ireland, and, you know, everybody is celebrating you and queuing up to go to the movies to see your films and things.
It was a bit more complicated.
And
than that.
Perhaps complicated, but we like to simplify things sometimes here. And then this series came out, the birth of the Spencer family.
Yeah.
And you were regarded as a traitor to Ireland.
Not by all.
Not by all.
But by a noisy sum.
It actually sounds, though, it was pretty grueling.
It was. At the same time, enormously invigorating.
Freeing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I was the first Irish person to win the Booker Prize. A small country, you know, a big prize. It puts you under a spotlight that you don't necessarily want. I was being invited to open supermarkets, you know, all sorts of daft stuff that a writer should never go near. Or, you know, strictly nobody with a bit of self-respect should ever go near. And anyway, literally a year later, or even less than a year later, this was broadcast. The family was broadcast on both Irish TV and the BBC. And anybody expecting The Snapper 2 or The Commitments just got an almighty shock, you know. And there were those who absolutely loved it. They thought it was brilliant. And there were those who just hated it. And the ones who hated it were a bit more vociferous, shall we say. And they got death threats. And I was the subject of sermons on the church. And I'm really quite proud of that.
Oh, yes.
So I thought at the time, although it was hair-raising, I must have done something right. Because the one thing you don't want to provoke when you work and put it out there, I don't know if you can provoke indifference We could spend days discussing that.
That's a wonderful idea.
I would much rather a hugely negative reaction than nothing. Mm. And the reaction wasn't uniformly negative, but it was loud enough to, for example, stop all the invitations that I'd been saying no to.
They just dried up at once.
Completely and utterly, which was brilliant in a way. There wasn't a little bit of me saying, why won't they let me open a supermarket or kiss a baby? That wasn't my own. Why are they not asking me to join this, that and the other, or this photo op? It all stopped so I could concentrate on the right things. And, you know, so I didn't have to fight for my private life anymore, which was great. And it was a great piece of work. I got to say that, you know, my contribution to it, I did a good job. But the actors were extraordinary, the director, everything went really, really well. You know, it was a good piece of work. So it wasn't as if I was being attacked because a shoddy piece of work was thrown out into the world. It was really good.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to the Irish writer, Roddy Doyle. Roddy, after that sort of crashing back to earth, you turned your attention. I mean, you had warehoused Paula Spencer at this stage, and maybe you thought that you had done with Paula Spencer
at this
stage. But there she was, waiting to reappear in 2024. So you crashed to earth, and then you turn your attention as a novelist to one of the most difficult issues in recent Irish existence, the IRA.
Yeah.
And I take it that you did so without any sense of obligation to any of the folklore of Ireland.
No, I didn't. Both my grandfathers, neither of whom I knew because they died when I was very, very young, were, as the verb is, involved in the war.
Isn't that a wonderful word?
It is. It is. They were involved in the War of Independence. And so both sides of the family, there was a certain mythology and a certain pride. The country was very young. I mean, the country, the island is, as you know, I don't know how old is
it's
an island.
It's been around.
But the state was a year younger than my father. He was born on the 8th of December, 1923, on the first anniversary of the execution of an anti-treaty Republican called Rory O'Connor. And he was named after Rory O'Connor. So his name was Rory, Roderick, Rory Doyle. I was named after him, you know.
Ah.
Never paid too much attention to that. You know, happy enough to be named after my father, but never paid too much attention. It was a little act of sedition, you know, because the maternity hospital where he was born, you just stepped outside onto what became O'Connell Street and it was all rubble, you know, from the 1916 rising and then from the Civil War. So it was like brand new and not everybody was happy with it, you know. So it was very fractious. And his side of the family, two uncles, one of whom went off to join the army in 2014, or at least 1914, lucky enough to survive, came back in 1918 and realised he was no longer in the army, he was in the British army. Things had changed.
Yeah.
Attitudes had changed. Yeah. He joined the National Army then when the state was founded, but his brother, Johnny, died during the Civil War on the anti-treaty side. So I'd imagine Christmas Day in that gaff for the rest of...
Ooh.
Yeah, must have been really difficult. Literally brother against brother.
Yeah.
I grew up knowing all this stuff. I grew up knowing, and anybody my age, we would have at one point known the Proclamation of Independence off by heart because we were in school in 1966. We would have seen all these old men in a line who were, you know, in the General Post Office in 1916. We would have grown up with this mythology. And a bit like, it's the duty of young people to sneer. And I was doing that, but creating fiction out of it, not necessarily just sneering, but I was, I was poking at pieties, I think.
Yeah.
And a great, huge admirer of Sean O'Casey. I forgot that for a good while. Recently began to rethink about it and rethink about him and me, and how huge an influence he had on me. But I was fascinated. Generally, I'm quite happy to read the work of writers and not be too curious about their lives. But two exceptions are Dickens and O'Casey, you know. So I'd read any biographies that are available, really, about both. Not sure why. Mm. O'Casey, it's more obvious because he's all his points, all his where all the houses he lived in, all the plays, they're all within walking distance of my house, you know.
Right.
And I imagined the children I taught in the 80s as being the grandkids of the characters from his plays. And he had attitudes about the 1916 Rising. He didn't think James Connolly and the Labour side of the resistance should have been involved in that rising. He didn't, you know, he said it would do nothing for working class people. And hence he wrote The Plough and the Stars, where all these people are being impacted by what's going on, but none of them are, well, one of them, but most of them are not involved, as the word is again. So I began to, you know, think, is there anything I can do that is so different to what I've done in the past? And I just decided I'll write big. I don't generally describe the physical appearance of characters or the buildings they live in, but in this case,
they talk.
I had to, because I was describing a world that doesn't exist anymore, even though a lot of the buildings are still extant and they're still, you know, they still serve a public purpose. You don't go to Dublin in the hope that you'll wander streets that are exactly the same as they were in 1916. So I was recreating and looking at photographs, reading books. And I can't remember exactly why I came up with Henry Smart, but I remember a man who became the Taoiseach or Prime Minister of Ireland eventually was 16, Sean Lemass, 16 in the GPO. And I think back then we might have seen a young man, but a 16-year-old now, it's hard to see them as a young, you know.
Yeah.
Certainly in Western society.
Taking part in a rebellion.
Yeah. Yeah, with a gun.
With a gun.
Yeah. And I began to see Henry as a bit like that, you know, and then begin to, you know,
Henry becomes the central part of the IRA novels.
Yes.
The central character in the IRA novels.
And he takes the kind of the O'Casey line, really, although he's involved in 1916. It's like a boy's own adventure in some ways, even though his own like he comes from the tenements of Dublin, and it's as rough and as unfortunate as it could possibly be. And that was largely based on my interest in history and what I'd been reading about death rates, mortality rates in Dublin. Extraordinary, given it was officially the second city of the empire, there was no doubting it was a colony. We were a colony, you know.
Roddy,
mm-hmm.
How many people do you think understand what you said a moment ago, boy's own?
I haven't a clue.
Yeah. I know what you mean, because we inherited my uncle's volumes of Boy's Own stories. They're still there in my bookcase somewhere.
All right.
Boy's Own. But Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
For people who are not born there and live there, you read about Dublin all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Dublin is a literary invention.
Mm-hmm.
The map of Dublin is supposed to be in the heads of educated people. This is unfair.
Well, don't blame Joyce. I wasn't around.
It's not just Joyce. It's not just Joyce. It's this wonderful sense in reading, in your work, in reading Irish fiction, that we know where this building is. We know where Trinity is. We know where it's...
Yeah, yeah. There are various. I became a writer because I wasn't aware that there was any other art form that I could have a bash at. There was no Irish film industry that I was aware of, for example. There were no courses on how to make a film or how to write a book. So to me, it was the choice. Do it or don't do it.
Mm.
As to Dublin, to my, you know, as far as I know, everybody going back through both sides of the family, the vast majority are from the east coast of Ireland, so English was the language for quite a considerable time. But nevertheless, like, it was inflicted on us. The British came for a week and stayed for 800 years, as you know, and pushed the indigenous population, as they tended to do, further and further west onto the rocks and the stones. And all of that. And Cromwell, a revered figure in England, is reviled in Ireland, you know, quite reasonably. He came for a couple of years, and 1 in 10 of the population was dead when he went back where he came from, you know. So all these big, horrendous, events occurred in Ireland. And then the famine.
But before we get to the famine.
Well, it's important because it's where the Irish language died and we became...
Oh, is it?
Yeah. It's where really people either left the country or, in a way, to a degree, abandoned their culture because they thought, you know, perhaps the only way to survive is to concede and to start speaking English and start taking on English ways.
And come to Australia in very large numbers.
Yeah. So we're talking English suddenly. Or not suddenly. But there's a defiance in it, I think, a glorious defiance in it, because you bend the rules. I think all colonial people, all colonised people do. They bend the rules. The Queen's English. I think, is it the King's English now?
It is once
well,
again,
well, in Dublin
yes.
Sometimes, it's closer to the Queen's English, and I'm talking about the first Elizabeth, not the second one, you know, hanging on to slang that's in Shakespeare but is used nowhere else. And the Irish language is bubbling under as well. So there's a phrase that's used, anybody who's ever been in the company of an Irish person will hear it several times a day, I'm after doing this. Or I remember getting a text from one of my children when they were in school years ago. My phone buzzes on the desk and I look down and it says, I'm after getting into trouble. And at one level, I'm thinking, oh, God, no, I could do that. On the other hand, I was thinking, brilliant, that'll survive another generation, that way of expressing. Because it's a direct translation of Gaelic, or from Gaelic. Tom Tarish. And, and English as we speak it in Ireland, and therefore in a way write it, is... in almost like an act of defiance.
Exactly, but not just defiance, but a way of beating the nation that is colonizing you, because Irish English is so fabulously good.
Yeah, so are other branches of it, but I think this is where I think Beckett, who I've seen all the plays, a huge admirer. I haven't read much of the prose of Samuel Beckett, but there's a really brilliant answer to a question he was asked. He was asked in French, I think, are you British, Mr. Beckett? And his response was, au contraire. Now, in a way, that makes no logical sense whatsoever. What's the opposite to being British? Irish. And that is vital.
Contrary. Yeah.
That was vital to, less vital now, I think, because we're more, I think, probably more self-confident as a group of people than we used to be. And joining the European Union, the EU, was hugely opening culturally and politically and almost psychologically. We were no longer a little island off, you know, beside the noisy neighbours. But that notion of to be Irish is not to be English. And yet the contradiction would be, well, how come you speak English? But we speak it the way we want to speak it, you know? It's full of contradictions. When Queen Elizabeth II, the more recent queen, came to Ireland, the first ruling monarch to visit the country since independence, there were small coterie of protesters. And what the English journalists couldn't figure out was, how come the lads throwing stones were wearing Manchester United jerseys? You know, so it's full of little contradictions, which are brilliant. They're great. You know, outside of violence, they're great, those little contradictions. So how can some, you know, hugely proud Irish person, you know, given out constantly about Britain and everything British, use the English language and won't make the effort to learn Irish. It's full of contradictions, and that probably makes it stronger still.
The Guardian has just worked out the 100 best novels.
Oh, I had a quick gawk at that, yeah.
Yeah, 100 best novels. Number three, Ulysses. Would you put Ulysses at number three?
Well, I was interested in it because, you know, if that list was 20 years ago, it would probably be number one. So it's really interesting that Middlemarch is number one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found that the most interesting thing about it. I think, like everybody else, I like lists, you know, and I've been asked a lot, what's your favourite five films? What's your, you know?
Yes.
I don't lose sleep over. I would concede that Ulysses would probably have to be very high up. If you were to ask me, not necessarily the best, but what my favourite, it wouldn't be in the top 10. It may not even if you said the top 20. I admire it. I've read it twice, but it wouldn't be a book that I absolutely... I love passages of it. Where Leo Bloom is wandering around Dublin, I love that. When Stephen, the younger lad, is inflicting his own head on us, I find that quite tiresome. And I think maybe we're supposed to. I'm not sure. But the episodes where Leo Bloom is present, it's not just age, because I felt that when I was a young man, you know. So, yeah, it's a great, great book. But it's a little bit like Van Morrison, you know. It's official that Astral Weeks is his best album. But I prefer Moondance. I would concede that Astral Weeks is one of the best, is one of the great achievements of rock music history. But give me Moondance. I prefer it as a record. So there is a difference
and
between
Joyce,
the best.
Maybe.
Joyce, I think I would prefer Dubliners, the collection of short stories.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, just as Ulysses, you get a great sense of where you're going in Ulysses when Leo Bloom is wandering around. Dubliners does the same thing. He had a great grip on geography.
You write short, don't you?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I don't imagine you writing an 800-page novel.
No. I think A Star Called Henry is the longest. It's about 124,000 words.
Yeah.
So that's a long novel.
Yeah, yeah, that's fairly.
I've just finished one that's 86,000 words. What I do is I write too much at the beginning. I deliberately write too much as I get to know what I'm writing about and I get to know the character and the other people who meet that character and become characters. So I write too much, then I whittle it down. So if I was, you know, The Snapper, for example, which is a short novel, was literally twice as long when I finished the first draft. The book I've just finished, and again, I'm not sure if it is finished, but it's temporarily finished.
Seems to be.
I think I threw about a third of that in the bin. When you write too much, or when I write too much, I'm quite happy then getting the red marker out and running lines through paragraphs. And sometimes it's a word, sometimes it's a paragraph, sometimes it's a gang of pages that just go in the bin. But so I write big, but then I whittle it down. The books, yeah, the Henry Smart books of necessity are longer, but the other ones, the ones that are set in the more recent past or the present day, tend to be shorter, yeah.
I want to ask you some really pompous questions. I mean, even more pompous than the questions I've
asked.
I'll
try to give you equally pompous answers.
Right. Let's have that as a pact between us. Roddy, why do we want to make people laugh?
Well, it's a very good question. I'm surprised sometimes when people do laugh. But today, do you know, in 2026, I don't think there's anything as powerful as a group of people roaring or laughing or reacting to something at the same time in the same place. So I go to football matches in Dublin, you know, every second Friday night. And it is so invigorating and wonderful to be in the company of thousands of people who are shouting at the referee, who are reacting to a goal or a close thing or a goal against our team. And then there's something brilliant about laughter. You know, it's why some films you can sit in an empty cinema and feel lucky. And other films you're thinking, I wish it was full, you know. the first time I saw The Life of Brian, there were only three people in the cinema.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was banned in Ireland at that time.
It was not banned.
It was, yeah. This is how changed the country is. Banned in Ireland, so I went to it in London. And I didn't deliberately go to London to see The Life of Brian.
Flew to London there to see The Life of Brian, yeah.
But I went to it again months later, and the cinema was full. And it was, you know, quite rightly a collective experience, you know, that outburst of laughter, or outbursts of laughter. And to a degree, laughter, it's an act of love, and it's also, I think it's an affirmation, life is somehow worth living. It's why we laugh a lot at funerals in Ireland. Not because we're delighted, you know,
in most cases.
That the person who's dead is dead.
Have you seen that thing on Instagram or wherever it is?
I'm not on Instagram.
No. Look, it's somewhere out there, YouTube. I have to be told what these things are. It's an Irish funeral.
And is it the man at on the counter singing?
No. The man in the coffin has pre-recorded a message saying, get me out of here! And nobody, I mean, somebody around the grave knew it.
Yeah.
But nobody else really did. And there was this infinitesimally short look of shock. And then the pleasure and the, it was just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, the music, I was asked, you know, about music at my own funeral. And I don't know if you see or know about Match of the Day. It's on Saturday nights on BBC.
I know of it. Yeah.
It's highlights of that day's football matches. And the music has been the same since the show started over 60 years ago. And that's what I want when the coffin is going towards the flames.
Haven't you considered that jazz classic, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me?
Yeah, but there's some of them now have become... I'm hearing the same songs now when I go. And, you know, I haven't been to a wedding in years and years. I've gone to a lot of funerals.
Yeah.
And it tends to be the same songs that are a little bit, I don't know, clever. They're brilliant.
Yes. But maybe clever isn't the right mood for a funeral.
Yeah, but if they reflect the taste of the person who's dying, I think grand.
Do you feel that your own generation is starting to die?
Well, that's true. They are, yeah. I've lost friends. Yeah, it's a shock. The only good thing about growing old from the point of view of a writer, like, it's awful. It's awful, but it's material. Physical decay. My
Jesus,
hearing.
You're ruthless, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's inevitable. It's happening. I'm wearing hearing aids now for 4 years. You get a pair of glasses, new pair of glasses. People will say, oh, they really suit you. They look great. Now, nobody's going to come up to you and say, I just saw the back of your head. Those hearing aids look fantastic. They say, oh, you'd hardly notice them,
yes.
Do you know? And it does change the perspective because you hear some things so clearly wearing the hearing aids. It distorts in a way. So in a way, it's its own form of entertainment. But on the other hand, then there's an added anxiety. I don't wear garments that don't have a zip at the front anymore because, you know, taking off a jumper or a hoodie with the hearing aids on a street, for example, it's just too nerve-wracking because if you lose a hearing aid, it's you're several grand down.
Yeah,
also,
the money.
Yeah.
Let alone the indignity.
Yeah. They just
let alone the disability.
Yeah. And then, you know, getting them replaced will take a long time.
I now understand why I see older people, older, not old, I mean, you're so much younger than me, wearing zippers.
Yeah.
Velcro, are you?
Oh, God, no.
Not Velcro, you're
no,
still tying
I'm off
your own
one
shoelaces.
Way flight to Switzerland if I have to, if somebody suggests. I
Velcro.
Velcro.
Okay.
Getting on the bus, I have free travel. In Ireland, once you reach 66, you can travel free throughout the country on trains and buses, and it's brilliant. It's like the state gives you this, off you go and play. You know, it's not the cost, because public transport is relatively cheap in Ireland, you know, it's not the cost. But myself and a friend, we'd had a few pints in town. We got on the bus. And the minute we got on the bus, two young women got up out of the seat and offered us the seats. That was great. We were delighted. It was very funny, but we were delighted. Anyway, the seats at the front are supposed to be for older people if they want them. But I also got on a bus where a woman of about 50 got up and offered me her seat. And that's probably the most humiliating thing that's ever happened. Now, I was on my way upstairs. I was like a gazelle going up the steps. But she just, I think she wanted to humiliate me. You know? But that was that was in, you know, you're talking about your lists. That is easily in the top 10 most humiliating things that's ever happened to me. Look, so growing old is material. You know, when you're a writer, it's got nothing else going for it.
Roddy, I had a lot of very literary questions to ask you. Our time is nearly up, and I haven't even begun on the list, really. I got diverted.
I don't do short answers anyway.
splendid diversions.
I'm a novelist.
I began by saying that your career can be measured out in families. Have you done with the Spencers?
I don't know.
You don't know? Paula Spencer could reappear. I mean, she's there in the latest novel. She could appear again.
I'm not closed to the idea. No plan. No, I didn't have a plan for when I thought about the second one, and I didn't have a plan when I wrote the third one. It suddenly became a good idea. So who knows? It might well pop. She might pop up again, but I don't know is the only answer to that.
You don't
question.
Feel that you're their prey, do you?
No.
No. You're in control here.
Oh, it's a guilt-free zone. Yeah, they do exactly what I want them to do. Characters, all of them. Including dying.
Obeying it all.
I'm determined they're all going to die before me.
Right. Okay. That's fair enough. Here, Sydney Writers Festival.
Yeah.
You're talking with Kate Evans from Radio National, this very radio station.
Yeah.
On the bookshelf this Saturday.
Yeah.
You've been around Radio National. I've done some research, you know. You've been on Radio National many times in your career. We've given you a useful boost, I reckon.
I feel so grateful.
Yeah,
I have no idea. It did feel familiar when I came in the building earlier. It did feel familiar. And there's a picture of the bananas in pyjamas that I reckon I saw the first time in 1993. The bananas are looking a bit rotten at this stage.
No, they're still there. They're still doing their work. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that you needed a pass to get into the building, frankly. I thought you would just be bowed through.
I was a bit taken aback, yeah, I thought, yeah.
Don't they know who I am, sort of thing.
Exactly.
Exactly. So you are at the Writers' Festival on Saturday.
And on Friday.
Yeah. And the thing to make absolutely clear to listeners is that that's going to be live streamed. So it can be listened to around Australia.
Is that right?
Rather like this show.
All right. Yeah. No, I wasn't aware of that. I should have been, but I wasn't.
Yes, it's not just a narrow little Sydney audience at all. No,
it's a narrow Australian audience.
It's a national audience, and the details of that will be up on our website, so Grand. That people can tune in. Roddy, thank you.
Thank you
for joining us on Late Night Live.
No, I enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
A pleasure. I've been talking to Roddy Doyle, whose latest book, The Women Behind the Door, was published, it's a couple of years ago now, isn't it?
Two
years ago.
Literally, yeah.
Yes. But he promises that he has another one that's just about to come out.
Well, hopefully next year sometime, yeah.
Hopefully next year. Has there been a year in the last 30 when you haven't published, broadcast or screened something?
Oh, there's been a lot of years.
Really?
Yeah. Don't ask me to name them.
The fallow years.
Either that or, you know that lovely phrase, work in progress, which usually means I'm watching football on the telly instead of working.
Yes.
Yeah, so there have been times when there's been, it's not that there's nothing going on, but there's no new work that's worth showing.
Beautifully put. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Roddy, very much for coming on the show. And that's the show. On our next, we're talking to Tarek Bakoni, whose book, Fire in Every Direction, is a unique queer coming-of-age story set among Palestinian refugee communities in Jordan and Lebanon. And we're talking to economic seer Satyajit Das about the impact of Trump's war on the finances of the globe.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.